Western Massachusetts. What season is this? How many?
47th
season.
Wow.
That's, I don't know if that's true or not, but it sounds good. So we'll have our lecture series the first Friday of every month, except for January, which we've decided to put on a Sunday, partly because of the material. It takes a little longer than a couple hours. And we wanted to try to have something on a Sunday afternoon in the middle of the winter, so people could get there and then go out for dinner and sort of make a day of it. So pay attention to the emails. They'll tell you about that. And there are two workshops so far. Thayer might do a workshop. I might do a workshop. We might do a workshop. The first one is in November after the Dream Animal Lecture. It'll be Saturday here in Seeley Hall. And it will be a continuation sort of the lecture with Penny Tarasuk. And then the last in May, the one on the Wars of the God and Addiction by David Shane from New Orleans. There will be a workshop on Saturday on the archetypal evil in addiction. So maybe a few other workshops. Okay. So we have our Western Mass. Does everybody know our website in here? Anything about the website? And if you want to be on our email list and you aren't, please sign up and we'll get you on the email list. And so I want to just say thank you to my board members, Dan Grunwald, who's our web magician. I don't know where he gets his pictures. It's amazing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Judy Hall, our new secretary. And Carol Beauvais, who's our community organizer. So if you want to help her organize anything, go talk to her. And Thayer Green, who's our Jungian analyst from the beginning. And I'm Erica Lorenz, the president. So thank you all. And also Mona Schieber. Where are you, Mona Schieber?
She just
went out. She just left. She's coming back. She helps man our Facebook page. She's a volunteer who does our Facebook page. So now we don't take any breaks tonight. And the bathroom, there's a bathroom right there. It says men, but I don't think we have to worry about it because we're probably the only people in the building tonight. So if you need to take a bathroom break, just quietly go and come back. And we ask for a contribution of $10 if you can do that, or more, or less, depending on where you are. And all is welcome. And we're also, if anybody can help us get the brochures up to the hill towns, if you live sort of far out, and there's a place you can put up a brochure, because those are the places where I think the brochures help the most to get the word out.
If you're from Franklin County or up that way, see me, because I live in Wendell, so it'd be great to know who you are and coordinate.
Did everybody hear that? Okay, so I'm going to make a few announcements. There is a wonderful dream conference happening through the Boston Jung Institute, which is a training institute in Boston. And it's happening on October 18th, 19th, 18th and 19th. It's called Wisdom of the Dream. That sounds familiar. And it's 2 days, and it looks like it's really interesting. So I encourage you to go to it. There are some scholarships for students. And there are some professors. If anybody knows any professors who are interested in Jung, you might pass this on. And also, if anybody's coming from a college or one of the universities and you know a place to put a brochure, that would be really helpful, too. So I'm going to put these over there on the table, so if you're interested, you can take one. And if anybody hasn't heard, the Jung Boston Institute has an auditor program so that you can go and study the first phase of the seminars and not have to train to be an analyst. And then you can, if you want to continue training, you can add that will be towards your training. But it's a wonderful program. So I'll put these over there, too, if anybody's interested. And there.
I think you need to mention that you, in order to enter the auditor program, you have to have had 100 hours of Jungian analysis.
Right. So that's to enter the program as an auditor or candidate. And that's because you cannot do this work if you don't have some experience with your own psyche, which is very important. So I'll put that over there, too. And you can ask any of the analysts in here about it if you're interested. Okay, let's see what else. So our next lecture will be October 3rd. We're starting at 7 p.m., as you've noticed. And it's The Archetype of Betrayal, The Dark and Bright Side of the Individuation Process by Paul Anderson, who's a Jungian analyst in Boston. He's coming out to give us a lecture.
Sanderson.
What?
Sanderson.
I thought that's what you said.
Oh, I didn't hear that.
Did I say? Well, anyway, it's Paul Sanderson. I have my prompt over here. Okay. So tonight, we're going to be doing, which I'm really excited about. We haven't done this before. We're showing the first of... Has anybody seen Mythos, the lecture series by Joseph Campbell? A few people?
I think we were actually at some of them. Yeah,
yeah, she was. So we'll have some historians on the panel. So Joseph Campbell, who was the mythologist who started at Columbia, right? And then left to study mythology on his own because he did not like the way mythology was taught, and ended up teaching at, well, Susan Sarandon will tell us all about it. So, and we're going to be watching the first of the series in Mythos called Psyche and Symbol, which Dan picked out, which he was excited about. And then we'll have to, after the film, Richard Trousdale, Anita and Thayer Green, and myself, the local analyst, will sit up here and just, we'll have a discussion and dialogue with you. And we are recording it tonight, the dialogue, the discussion, because a lot of people who can't be here, you can watch the film, but you can't hear what we have to say. So we will be recording it, and if you have a personal question that you don't want recorded, just say stop the recorder, please, and we'll just stop it and then resume it, okay? So, and then afterwards, we all tromp over, we hope we all tromp over, to the Mosaic Cafe, which is on Masonic Street, to continue to have a wonderful, yummy discussion about whatever we want from the film and the lecture and the panel and whatever else comes up. So please join us after the lecture. Okay, I think I covered it. All right, so... Okay, what I'd like to do is, rather than us give our own whatever right now, I'd like to just open it up to just start a dialogue back and forth between you and the film and us and whoever wants to say whatever and think about this whole thing together. So, anybody want to start with a question or a thought? Yes?
Before people leave, I worked with a therapist, humanist therapist, 10 years ago, taking Campbell's hero's journey to make therapy for diseases. So I'm looking for anyone who wants to talk. We had diabetes as a hero journey, etc., every heart disease. And I'm looking for people who'd like to work on this. It's quite phenomenal to utilize it as a healing tool, the hero's journey. So I just want to say, if you want me finally, I'm looking for therapists to actually bring this to life again.
Did everybody hear that pretty much? Okay. So speak up when you ask. Any thoughts here? Okay. So, what is your name?
Amy Zuckerman.
Amy Zuckerman. Okay.
I'm not leaving. I'd love to find people who are curious and work on this.
Yeah. We'll come to the salon afterwards, too. Okay. Any other thoughts or... Yes?
I have a question about his characterizing of what he calls the Orient, which seems very dated.
Yes.
And,
yes.
Orientalism?
Yes.
Wonder what you think of it.
Seeing this, Thayer, I remember Thayer and I actually sitting in the audience for some of these lectures, and I remembered why I liked him so much, because of his asides. and the language that he would come out with, and the illustrations to humanize everything. But it is dated. I couldn't agree with you more. I think a lot of the meditation that we all, I mean, including myself, are involved in, I think the so-called gurus, or now our spiritual leaders, are much more aware of the cultural differences. And that was very simplistic, and I thought quite old-fashioned, what he had to say about the East and the West. I couldn't agree.
What year? Could someone just say what year this was filmed, roughly?
86.
I don't think that it is simply the Oriental that is somewhat outdated. In terms of contemporary Jungian theory and even history, I think this is oversimplified. And, you know, one of the things he didn't develop, he talked all about the anima, as Jungian men are likely to do, but he ignored the development of the animus. And there's also, thanks to Jim Hillman and others, the point of view that men can have an animus and women can have an anima. So it's more complex, which doesn't detract from the, I think, essential insight that he translates from Jung about the nature and structure of the psyche. I think that there's much legitimacy, and I work with those assumptions in many different ways. So that's my thought on that.
Yes, and I agree. Yes, it is dated, but one of the wonderful things about Campbell is that he begins a lot of his work by saying that mythologies change, and the problem is always to try to move beyond your myths, the mythology that we're in, to see what myth is evolving that we need to find now. And I think he would be amused himself at some of the things he finds himself saying. I also want to say that he had great respect for Indian thought and Hindu thought particularly. One of his great teachers was Heinrich Zimmer, and Campbell wrote an introduction to Hindu philosophy and mythology, which were the lecture notes that Zimmer left when he died, and Campbell finished the book. So, like all great teachers, he simplifies to make a point, to make the points that he was making. But thank you for picking it up.
I didn't go to Sarah Lawrence, so I didn't have the orientation that we saw in the film. However, when I studied myth, it was connected with ritual. And the story that I got was that myth comes out of ritual, and that ritual is what is innate, inherent in every culture and in every person, and that the myth comes after ritual to explain the myth, to explain the ritual.
I don't think I agree with that. I think the ritual is a product of experience, and the experience is numinous. It has a transpersonal energy and power to it. And the ritual is a product of that in order to try to capture and repeat the numinosity of the original numinous mystical experience. That's the way I would see it.
And then how does how does myth relate to ritual?
I think the ritual sustains the power of the myth. The Lord's Supper or the Holy Communion or baptism or forms of sacrifice are all rituals that are rooted in powerful events, experiences that then get repeated through the power of ritual. In the Christian tradition, the sacraments are really the structured ritual actions that renew the transpersonal and numinous experience.
I think in our everyday life, and particularly in family life, there are rituals in any family. The family came first, and the feelings in the family came first, and all of the cultural things in the family came. The rituals attempt to provide a setting or a context in which those things get re-evoked. That's how I would see it.
I think for a ritual to really be alive, it has to come from, as Thayer was saying, an experience. And to me, that's where the power of the ritual comes from, the self, the unconscious, the power of the person itself, through the myth, through the person, through the culture or the person. Or any other?
Yes.
If we use Campbell's order of things, of myth, of function, top function is the mystic, which you would call which it would gain, an event would gain its numinosity from the mystic. And he goes down in order, where ritual is an animated behavior. So through the numinous, you become animated and connected to the numinous through the animation of ritual. So if that's the order of things, then mythos would come before ritual.
Okay. Yes.
I'm interested in this whole, I'm new all the time, but I was just thinking about rituals.
Would you speak up?
I'm sorry. I'm new to all this, but I was thinking about ritual and what a ritual means. And at the previous question about Orientalism and how that's dated. So through various times, how our rituals change. Thinking about breastfeeding, for example, which is a point that he made that was innate, that the baby comes out and knows to do it. Now, we would consider that today, perhaps because we're promoting breastfeeding, not a ritual thing, but just the best thing to do. But I can remember a time during the 50s and 60s where we were being told that formula was the best thing to do. And perhaps that breastfeeding could be considered a ritual. Something that we were doing because it was what we felt innately was better to do. We couldn't explain why because it was going against society. So I think there are times when it's the myth and times when it's the ritual that could come first, depending on whether it's coming from something innate or something that's coming from, like, the society.
Hmm. And to me, that there can be a difference there of whether the cultural ritual fits with my innateness.
Okay. I'm curious about when he spoke about the self projections. So he talked about anima projections and animus projections.
Can everybody hear?
I'm curious about what would be examples of a self projection.
What are examples of the self projection? Yeah. Okay.
Mm-hmm. I love what he called it, twinkle.
Yeah.
It's twinkle.
I think one of the places you see this is in the projection onto really powerful, charismatic leaders who attract not just projections of
the heroic or other aspects of mythology, but they are godlike. And that projection of divine presence is a projection of the self.
I would like to give a personal example of a projection onto an apple tree of the Great Mother. I remember having a dream in which it said, well, your mother is a tree. And I thought, well, that's kind of an odd dream. And then I remembered as a child that there was an apple orchard next to our home. And it was there was a place I could go there, completely out of reach of my mother's voice. And an old apple tree, I mean a really gnarled old apple tree, was in that orchard, and I remember going and sitting between the roots of that tree and feeling my back against the trunk of the tree. And I would stay there until I no longer knew whether where I began or the tree ended. And that, I believe, is a good example of a projection of the self onto a plant, let's say. But it isn't just, it's animal worlds too. I projected that onto a cat of mine also. That kind of place of just being and coming to me when I felt depressed, for example, and snuggling up because it knew something here that I wasn't aware of and gave me great comfort.
In our time now, we see a problem when the self gets projected onto a child, and the child becomes the self, the divine child. And that can be very damaging to a child at some point, because the whole idea of self and that, all of the power, the numinous power of it, is projected into the child. And the child can become infected with it. You can see the narcissistic inflation start. And then the kid gets scared because they don't know what the hell to do with all of this numinous attention that the parents are giving to it. And I see some heads nodding out there. You recognize this. It's particular in our time, and I don't really understand fully why. But it has something to do about hope for the future. You can see that, but it's damaging.
Would it be helpful if I passed the mic around, if I tried to get the mic to people? Can people hear the questions?
Fine.
We're fine? Okay.
I made some notes as we watch that, and I'd like to share a few of them because they all have to do with the relation of the personal level of our lives to some mythic archetypal pattern, which is what basically he's talking about in this talk. First, I want to raise an objection to Dante's division of the stages of life, because I'm 88, and that puts me in the archetype of decrepitude, which may be honest, but I resent it. One story that I still carry around from our family life. When our oldest daughter was 4 years old and we were in our summer home, on one beautiful summer morning, Anita and I were lying in bed and sort of lazing and being close, and in danced giggling our daughter Becca, and she circled around the double bed to Anita's side and crawled over Anita's body and snuggled up to me, giggling, and then put her little butt against my thigh and put her feet
on Anita's thigh and shoved. And Anita rolled over once and disappeared over the mattress. And there was this, and then she giggled even more and snuggled closer. So after what was, I thought, a fairly significant moment of silence, Anita's puzzled face appeared over the edge of the mattress and looked at me, and I said, "Oedipus Schmedipus, I win, you lose." Now that was an archetype. That was a universal mythic moment in a family's life. So I wanted to mention that because that's part of the way it is. These archetypes are part of the structure of our human relations and our internal experience. Then another archetypal experience occurred to me in a dream that was actually occurring in my life. I had left 9 years in the pastoral ministry and being a chaplain of Amherst College and begun training to be a Jungian analyst, and went to my first training analyst. Some of you may have read some of his books, Edward Edinger, and he constellated for almost everybody in the training program the father. Yeah. He was a powerful psychic presence. And within a month or two of starting my training, I had the following dream. I found myself in the central chamber of an Egyptian pyramid. And I was hanging out with a group of rather middle-aged type women, and dowagers. It was like the women's group in my church before I changed careers. It was called the Women's Union. And I'm a mother's son, and I, have always had more issues to deal with in relation to the mother in that regard. And trumpets blew loudly, and this procession marched into this central chamber of, Egyptian soldiers and so forth, followed by Pharaoh. And Pharaoh's assistant went to the center of the chamber. There were two, and then it was conveyed that I and there were two other men similar to me were to be tested by touching a papyrus scroll. And the one who touched the scroll and did not die would be become the lieutenant governor, or whatever you want to call it, to the Pharaoh. And so the three of us stepped forward, and I stepped forward, and I touched the scroll. And I didn't fall dead, and the other two men disappeared, because they really represented the masculine yang energy, the threeness. And at that point, you see, I had separated myself from the Women's Union and had aligned myself with Pharaoh, and I joined the procession. The trumpets blew, and we marched out of the central chamber of the pyramid. Now, if you want to have an archetypal dream, I would offer that up in competition. I mean, that was powerful. And this came at a point where I was working with a male analyst who constellated powerfully the father world, I was making a dramatic change in my career path, and I was going into a program of training that was initiatory. And so there was an enormous amount of archetypal energy involved in this experience for me. And I share it because I think it demonstrates, I mean, to me, Jung captures this more than anyone else in the psychological field.
There's a question back there.
Here we go.
Hi, thanks. My question is basically a follow-up to the story that you just told, the Ed Vishnevis story. And I can't help but wonder about, you know, not only the occurrence of that, but the follow-up to that, like the, you know, when that archetypal occurrence happens, then what, how did, what's a healthy way to approach that in that position that you find yourself in?
Okay. I just want to say, thank God she had conscious Jungian parents.
We weren't Jungians then. As the one who was pushed out of the bed, I just want to say that I continue to have a great deal of archetypal mother power in that also.
Well, I think the best answer is, fortunately, my daughter grew up and had a more balanced and realistic appreciation and perception of her father. I could quote some of her adolescent statements, but they aren't for public consumption.
I'm still thinking about Campbell and being dated and so on, that discussion, and I was wondering why some of the things that he said really struck me that way. And it occurred to me, if you could see the whole picture, he was talking to a student audience, and therefore he exaggerated certain things. And one of the things he exaggerated that I had a problem with was what he said about persona. There's nothing wrong with what he said about persona, but he said it from a particular point of view, which is persona, that things that are offered from the collective to put on your roles in society. And he's talking to a young audience, and what he's bringing up for them is, it's going to be your time while you're here at Sarah Lawrence or wherever to break out of that. And then the example he gave of the two girls coming, Republican family, do you see what I mean?
Yes.
And I want to put in, as many of us know, a good word for persona. If you were raised in a way that you got no persona or a confused signal about what, and had a hell of a hard time finding your way out in life at first until you found what roles really made sense to you and how to present yourself in life, that can be a terrible, painful problem. So there's a good thing to be said about persona too. But anyway, I think, given what we know about Campbell, he was a great teacher, and he was, I think, framing the way he said certain things for that particular audience.
Thanks, Dick. Yeah, he was.
You're absolutely right.
You're right.
Yeah, yeah. I think so.
In that regard, I think the simplicity, or what I got from Campbell, was he was kind of in the channel of Western thought, and his reference to or that photo of Athens where the elders were, and I was going to say it's a good thing you should be feeling gratitude now that you're not in India, but you're in Athens, at least in Campbell's mind. In that context, the traditional conflict of the world has been between East and West, between the ego of the East, that's what at least has been taught, the ego and the individualism of the West versus the selflessness of the East. So he was parroting that traditional conflict, which on some level still exists. But in terms of persona and duty, God, what's more persona and duty than America, duty, honor, country? You must yours is but to do or die. You know, it's so that there's this intermingling in our time, but perhaps not in other times.
And for me, I think in that the beauty, well, part of the beauty of Jung is his looking at archetypes and cultures from all over the world and seeing the oppositions of them in various ways, and then talking particularly sort of the masculine, feminine, and some of the... and then talking about the ultimate goal is the conjunctio. It's like perhaps there was some reason why these things got separated out in different parts of the world, in different cultures, but ultimately they had similar archetypal, fundamental, elemental principles. But the ultimate is to hold the tension of the opposites, whatever that is, personally or culturally or internationally or politically or whatever, and then to hold that until something new can come from that. So to me, that's one of the conjunctio in alchemy, and that's one of the beauties of the system of the opposites in Jung, and is exploring all these different opposites that have a similar archetypal basis.
Yes.
Well, don't you think that one of the things that might make this presentation of Jung dated is that now, since that lecture, even in that short time, 20 years, there's this globalization, so-called globalization, where the small, the smaller cultures have been disseminated out and integrated into large. So people become more aware of other cultures and integrated with each other. Does that make any sense at all?
Yeah.
So that perhaps the Jungian idea applies, but it has to be modernized to the fact that we're all becoming much more aware of all the different cultures in the world and integrating.
Yeah, there's a wonderful book that I've been reading, which probably a lot of you have read, called Quiet, which is about introversion and extroversion. And she does, in one of the chapters, she talks about soft power, the Eastern way of, it's very introverted culture, versus the way we have become totally overly.
Totally extroverted. I think we've just had a moment.
And she's a lovely writer, and she talks about how the people who, the Easterners who have come into Western universities, they were told that,
they have to speak up.
They have to learn how to speak up, and they don't know how to do that, and it's very awkward, and vice versa. And to me, that's a sort of an interesting, just a beautiful example of the way that these cultures are coming together and need to find the balance.
I simply wanted to add to what you were saying. We have not up to this point mentioned the internet, and that has been the primary engine, I believe, of globalization, that anywhere in the world we can send a message. I have a daughter who is in her own way a therapist and a healer, and she has a following in Japan. It's an organization that started in the States called the Pathwork Program. Some of you may know about it. And at certain times in the evening, she has to get on Skype so she can teach a course about her form of therapy to classes in Japan. And she does it through a translator in Japan. And to me, that is about as clear an example of globalization as you could have.
I'm interested in what you make of the two paths that he delineated, the right path and the left path. A path conforming to convention where everything maps out, and a path where things fall apart that's more driven by shadow.
Let me just say that I think the right and the left have always had that kind of thing attached to them. I mean, in Italian, the left is sinistra. And the right is the right way, obviously, and the way of the culture, and the way of at least performing well, and not getting yourself into jail or anything of that sort. And the left has always been the path that you take that turns into many paths very often, and becomes like a maze, and you try to run, and it is a place of danger. I look on an internal journey as dangerous as some of the journeys that explorers took across the United States, for example, when they didn't know anything about the territory they were going into. When one goes deeply into the unconscious, one has no idea what kind of territory, what kind of beasts, what kind of murderers, what kinds of thieves that one is going to meet there. And it's as dangerous a journey, at least for some, a great deal of danger. I remember one woman I worked with, every time she took a step forward and almost came to a place where she could be herself, she would actually have a fall. I mean, literally, she would trip off the curb. It was as though something kept pulling her back and pulling her back, and it was very dangerous for her to move forward. It was a kind of death experience whenever she attempted to move forward.
I think of your question, and two images came to me. One is the need sometimes to move on the right path. And I'm thinking of something that Campbell said about our lack of rituals, about we miss rituals in our society, and I know from some of his other work he talks about particularly the rituals of initiation. And I'm thinking of how, and this is a very simple example, of how for many young people, going in the army and all of that rigorous training feels good to them. It's a right path experience. It's an initiation into, okay, this is the way I'm in. The other kind of path, is the image that came to me there was of Robert Frost's great poem, Two Paths Diverged in a Wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. And it's that point where you're ready to leave the common path, but I think you've got to get the established sense, some sense of an established path first somehow. And then you start, perhaps, now psychologically I think that's also true, that the what Campbell was talking about, the shadow, those are some paths in us that we need to learn about, that they're in there, and they are guiding us. And the problem is we don't always know it. They're hidden paths, but they're in there. Or they're part of us. And so learning about them is the preparation for then what is the right path in the other sense, not just right hand, left hand, but what is your right path, mine, which may be completely different. So those are some of these. It's an interesting question.
You need to remember that the devil is the left hand of God. And the left, as Anita said, the sinistra is the sinister side. And it's the way to the unconscious. It's the way into the darkness. At an archetypal level in human experience, left and right very often have that. I think even for left-handed people it may be true. So I think the paradox that Nick has just raised is that in some way finding the right path for us as individuals means we must go to the left in order to find our way to our own right path. That Campbell made the point, Jung makes the point, that for most people who go into Jungian analysis, there has to be some disintegration of the persona adaptation that they've been living with that has given them their identity in order for something new to emerge out of the darkness, out of the depths, that can transform their sense of who they are and give them a new, deeper identity that's more rooted in the self. But you can't do that if you don't have an adequately strong ego. So the first task of a therapist or analyst is to assess whether this individual has a strong enough sense of identity and of some kind of functional agency for their lives. If they don't, that's what you got to work on, sometimes for several years, before this taking the left path can occur.
Can I just ask Paul what Thayer said back to Anita's patient who kept falling off things? Was that a sign that she wasn't strong enough? I mean, as the analyst, did you take that as a warning that somatically her body was giving you and her lots of messages, or was it just part of the disintegration process? I mean, that's a very tricky call sometimes that an analyst has to make.
No, it's a very tricky call. In her case, she had a determination and a persistence mm-hmm. that I could count on. And she knew that she had that tremendous pull because of her family situation. Now, when someone comes in and they've stolen something from the bank in the town, I rejoice. Because
in a dream.
I'm sorry. Sometimes I don't give all the context. Yes, in a dream, when they come in with a dream, I have stolen money. I've stolen a lot of money. So they find me taking their own stuff and getting off with it. I have another woman come to me, quite young, and she was just starting her job as a teacher in a new school. And she brought in several dreams. And I take dreams very seriously when there were earthquakes or fires or floods. Is there some way that a part of them is safe somewhere? Or how the dream ends? And there was nothing in any of these dreams that showed that she survived. And so I suggested to her that it might be better for her to really spend her time on her new job and later to come back to me, perhaps, or to someone else. And because I was frightened by the dreams. She wasn't at all, of course. But it is a very tricky place to be. Yes.
I think that this happens a lot with people who have a lot of trauma, that their sense of ego or sense of self has been so shaken that it is a very delicate journey to go back and open up the wounds that have been created, and that this is where the archetypes come in, because the archetypes, the destructive archetypes, have, because of the trauma, have become very powerful in the psyche. So to find the relationship to the healing archetype in the journey, with probably a lot of transference, a lot of projection onto the analyst or the therapist, and then also to find that edge where one can begin to have a dialogue with the destructive archetypes that actually, as Don Kalsha speaks of very wonderfully, that they originally started to try to protect the innocence and the fragility of the child, and they became so powerful that when the person starts to step forward, they go, "Oh no, you don't. Come back. Be safe. Come back. Don't hide. Don't come out. Don't go out there." So I think that in trauma, it's a very fascinating and winding and delicate journey. And in my experience, if somebody who's been very traumatized has had one person who has really seen the trauma and the reality of what they've lived in, that makes a significant difference of how they can then draw on the healing power.
Thank you. Yeah, that's great.
I'd like to go back just to something that Thayer said about the ego and finding one's sense of self in the kind of smaller S.
Let's talk about the bigger S.
Yeah, it depends again on what lens we're looking at, looking through that. I guess in the Jungian lens, it might be the bigger S. And I'm curious about the cultural piece. People from the East or the Middle East who have different ways of culturally being in society to the West, how that ego development occurs and how one works with that, especially if they're of one culture and they're now in another culture.
I think that Campbell really described the contrast between what Western relatively democratic culture is, where the individual is so much more valued, and where he was talking about you are whatever the persona is. It's not a question of having a persona. You are the persona. So I think that it makes it very difficult for people coming out of that culture to be able to connect and feel at home in a culture in which individual ego identity is a primary value. That's, I think, all I can say. One thing I wanted to say about what Erica was commenting on, the traumatized ego is really an ego that is reenacting over and over again the trauma. And one of the things that we see in our soldiers and our military coming back from four tours of duty in Iraq and Afghanistan and going through combat just too much for too long. We've just had the longest war in our history. And who says we're at peace? And last year I gave a talk on the experience of combat, because I was in it, but fortunately not like they have been. And one of the things that is so hard to do is to make the transition from living in an archetypal energized environment and daily confrontation moment by moment between life and death, and then coming back into this culture or any culture really, and having anything we could consider a sort of everyday normal ego existence. The ego has been traumatized and it's been archetypalized, is the way I describe it.
I want to disagree with what Campbell said about the fragile ego in the East versus the strong ego in the West.
Yes. Like, eh?
And to me, I think a lot of meditation teachers now, you know, meditation, it's you get rid of the ego. No, you don't get rid of the ego when you meditate. You have to have a strong ego to really open up to meditation. But to me, if you live in a culture where you have to be the persona, you have to take on certain cultural mores, to me it takes a tremendous amount of strength to find yourself in behind that or inside of it, versus our culture where you're sort of encouraged to do whatever you want, follow your bliss, blah, 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 where you might not have that such a sort of swaddling in a way to create a sense of self. So I think that's a very interesting thing. Go ahead.
I wonder if you could say something about what appears to be the rise of fundamentalism. One of the changes since Campbell gave this lecture might be increasing integration of different cultures into different parts of the world, increasing globalization. But it seems certainly that there's also been a huge rise in fundamentalism everywhere, in our society, but certainly across the world. And I'm wondering, it seems to me that the language that you're using to think about all these kinds of issues ought to be fruitful for investigating or having a way of understanding or a way of coming to terms with or looking to the future of that process. And I'm wondering if you could comment.
Well, I think that our connection to the self, our numinous connection to the cosmos, has been lost a lot, and people crave that. The soul craves it, and I think I lived in Houston, Texas, for 25 years, which is the Bible Belt, and it was very interesting to watch that and to work with people who had grown up in fundamentalist families, and which could be very traumatizing. But you also have to realize that fundamentalism is all over the place and has been here forever. So, but to me, the people who gravitate towards those kinds of rigid religious structures are craving something, but they're terrified. They don't know how to find it in themselves, and they're terrified, and they want to grab hold of something to make sure that they have it. It becomes very rigidified.
I've thought a lot about fundamentalism and what the dynamic is that surrounds it and supports it. And the things that strike me are it is a terrible fear of change, of having to include rather than exclude, of fearing that if I don't hold on to that which is literal and concrete and allow myself any kind of fluidity, flexibility, expansion, inclusion, I will be lost. That's too scary. Part of it, I feel, and Jung talks about this at some length, is that we have moved from the Piscean Age, 2,000 years, to the Aquarian Age. We are in the Aquarian Age. And he said that Martin Luther, and I'm trying to think, there was another figure, they were the early prophets of change when the Reformation came. And then you had the Counter-Reformation of the Catholic Church, which was a fundamentalist response. So that's what we're caught in. We are in a major transition I believe, in our global consciousness. And it's going to take 200-400 years for this to somehow stabilize or play itself out, if we have 200-400 years in the atomic age. But that's where we're at, as I see it.
Let's have one more question.
One more question?
I was just interested in what I know a lot of people have asked what wasn't, was dated, but what seemed to me or resonated with me to be really applicable to now is when you were talking about the lost mythology. And I'm just curious, when we talk about globalization and technology and where we're moving, how when he was saying that it takes time to establish a mythos in a society or in a culture, and time and our changes are happening so quickly that it's difficult to establish our mythology, and that might be part of our problem right now, yeah. We've lost our mythology. Just curious to know, where do you guys think our mythology is going, and are we kind of coming to the end of losing it and starting to resurrect it?
That's a very good question. I wonder that myself. I don't have any specific answers, but I think that there are a number of people who are really thinking about it and wonder if some of the old mythologies don't speak to us very much anymore. I disagree with that because I think they are elemental and primal and eternal. And perhaps it's the way, you know, when God is dead, so are all the rituals and mythologies, it seems to me. In the Aquarian age, and I happen to be an Aquarian, it is up to each individual, really, to find their own path. And the time of institutional churches are no more in some ways with the rise of fundamentalism, but... So it's very difficult. Do you have something more you want to say on that?
Do you think it's possible that the mythology we're going towards could be on a global, like, because we have so much access to the various mythologies and cultures and all that stuff, and also throughout the ages, we're rising into perhaps the position of God not being dead, but us elevating to a closer position, or if not the position of each being our own individual God, would we then create our own individual mythology and relate to each other in our various mythologies?
Well, one of the things I think that's so tricky is that we are not the archetypes. I am an individual, personal being. I relate to the archetypes, and I think that's a danger in a time of chaos and change, that we can easily get confused. I've had a fantasizing about this cyberspace. You know, I'm Skyping with a client and suddenly we get a bad connection and we go, what's going on? And I'm going, I don't know. It's cyberspace. And I've been having a fantasy about what is cyberspace? You know, what is the iCloud? It's like, it's fascinating. What an amazing symbol it operates, it happens, something's happening. And I suddenly today was imagining about it, and I thought, you know, someday we're going to know what cyberspace is, whatever that means. I don't think we have the conceptual ability to understand that right now. But someday we're going to know what cyberspace is, and then we'll be on a whole other level of reality. It's like meditating. I don't know. I was just going, wow, this cyberspace symbol of the cyberspace thing. So anyway, on that note, let's go. Yeah, Karen?
I was just going to say, have you read... Jung's An Answer to Job? It's a wonderful essay that in some ways might point to an answer to your question, and it's very complicated, but something about a shift from a collective myth to maybe this more individual. He's got the image of the paraclete, is that it? The penta, where each person carries sort of the God image, and it's not so much a global thing as more an individual thing.
And when Christ died and was resurrected, what he left behind was the paraclete, which
right.
was
so
to
that's
speak
like
the Holy
third...
Ghost, to speak to each individual person.
Yeah. So he sort of goes through a sort of history of Western religious traditions from Judaism, Christianity, and then there's this new sort of inchoate thing that he's talking about. And I think that was Jung's answer, and it's also partly in the Red Book, maybe. And that, again, the Red Book is Jung's own answer in a very beautiful and deep way. So I think that might be his answer.
So, if anybody wants to join us at the Mosaic Cafe on Masonic Street, that would be fun. So, thank you very much, and we'll see you next month, I hope.